I think I'll start. That'll be a couple of minutes. So, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. This is incredibly special to me to be here. This evening I will be spending the night at a campsite or a caravan park I have not stayed at for 42 years. So this is a very unusual trip for me, and there are some unexpected butterflies in me over this. So it is to be here again. It's always a privilege to come up and see you and to be here, and it's always something I treasure. And to be here invited to talk about meetings in which the whole church participates, half of it feels like a real privilege, half of it feels like a bit of a cheek, coming to tell people who have done that for longer than I have been here, for longer than I've been alive, is a great honour, and I really appreciate being asked to do that. So thank you for the opportunity. Forty-four years I have been in only two churches. One for much of the time I was there rather large, one for all of the time I've been there rather small, and much smaller than this room. I think we got close to 20 once or twice, which was very exciting, and then drifted back down to about half that. And in both places, the expectation that the whole body would function was part of the life of the church. And that should be normal. That's a statement that I should be able to make without surprising anybody. And it isn't. And there are reasons for that, mostly connected to the fall of man. And there are reasons most people, most Christian leaders, don't have meetings in which their whole congregation can participate. And having spent over 40 years in meetings where the whole church can participate, I understand their point. I think back to one or two experiences and go, yeah, no, this... I think back to one or two recent experiences, and I understand why most people don't do it this way. But I've spent my whole life in two places where the expectation is that the whole body would function. And that is not an accident. And I have no intention of spending any of my life anywhere where that isn't true. Which is tricky, because there aren't that many places. And there are places where the whole body can function, in theory, but that doesn't guarantee life. It doesn't guarantee that the Spirit moves. It doesn't guarantee... I remember reading somebody describing, and I won't name the denomination, a meeting of a particular group, and saying that they were some of the most predictable meetings he'd ever been in. That's not what a meeting of the full church is. The time I was born, which some of you will remember, Corinthians 14 verse 26 was a very popular verse. When you come together, everyone hath. It was always in good King James English. And even today, no matter which translation I read that verse in, I can only hear hath. There were an awful lot of people trying it. And their experiences varied, but most of them gave it up very quickly. And most of them gave it up very quickly because it was chaos, because it was anarchy, because it was damaging, because people got hurt, because people tried to take over, for a whole range of perfectly understandable reasons. And most of them came away with one simple and obvious conclusion: this can't be done. And I've heard people say, oh, it was very naive to think that the whole congregation could function. You might get away with it once or twice, but to do it for any length of time, that's just not going to work. I don't need to tell many people here that that's not true. But it isn't something that lives easily. It isn't something that simply you just try this and it works and it's glorious and so forth. And the people who think that, usually either they were there but they didn't see the work that was put in, or they weren't there right at the beginning when blood was shed. Mostly not literally. And I do mean mostly. And as a result of that, of those difficulties and the passage of time, that vision is very dim in the Christian world today, at least in this part of the world. I can't speak for everywhere, but I try and keep an eye out for what's going on here. And the vision of a whole body functioning is, at the lowest ebb it's been for a very long time. And part of the reason I'm so glad to be here is because I know that part of what the Lord intends me to do with my life is to do a little something about that. I'd like to think I could do a lot about it, but we have to work with what the Lord gives us and leave the rest to Him. And when Ben asked me to come up and talk about open meetings, meetings in which the whole body, I'm going to call them open meetings just as a phrase. I was initially thinking very much of practical things. What helps practically? And I have to say, it's a great blessing to me to have been in two very different places, which would have disagreed with each other on a good deal. Which does occasionally leave me slightly schizophrenic, but actually to see things done in very different ways, to see what's different, and also to see what's the same, some of which is not obvious without spending quite a bit of time. But before I do anything practical, before I talk about, you know, this helps, this doesn't, try and do more of this or less of that, it seems very important to me that we remember why such meetings matter. One of the things that has struck me very strongly is how easily we forget. Things that... We've done this for 30 years. We know it matters. But nobody's talked about why for 29 and a half years. And actually, the vision the Lord gives us, unless it's renewed, it dies. And sometimes it dies just by fading away and disappearing. Sometimes it dies in bloodshed and people fighting and arguing. Sometimes it survives, but it becomes... What's the word I'm looking for? It becomes a routine. It becomes a system. The life is gone. And we do this because this is what we did last year. This is what we did the year before. This is what we did the year before that. This has nothing to do with whether it's right or wrong. It's about the life in it. The life that flows through the Lord's people. The life that He puts in us. And whether we live by the life that He has given us or by routines and systems. And the problem with routines and systems is that no matter how good they are, if the life of the Lord doesn't flow through, one day you wake up and discover you're the Pharisees. That is the ultimate end of living by rules and routines rather than the life and spirit of the Lord. The Pharisees had an awful lot. If you looked on paper, they had an awful lot that was absolutely right. But it's not about what's on paper. It's about the heart, and it's about the life. And we don't meet openly with a whole body taking part because it's a good idea. To be honest, if you want neat and tidy meetings, it's an incredibly bad idea. If you want to avoid mess, if you want to avoid strife and conflict, it's a very bad idea. We struggle not to start in this world and in this realm. We struggle to see beyond the world around us and the things of this world. And anything that has life starts somewhere else, starts in another realm, starts with the Lord himself and with his purpose and his intent. And this is not something that is a new idea of his. The Lord's purpose isn't something that changes. The particular things he does change at a different time, but his core purpose, his intent, has never changed. It says in Ephesians, the Lord has an eternal purpose, a purpose which has been his since the beginning. I'll look at that a little later. But this is a purpose which the Lord has had for a very, very long time. And there are a few things it predates, and it's really important to remember what it predates. It predates my fall. It predates Adam being kicked out of the Garden of Eden. It predates Adam and Eve's existence and creation. It's something that was in the heart of the Lord when the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. It's been alive in him since before the beginning, before he uttered the first words. The fullness of that purpose, the fullness of the Lord's intent, that's an eternity's discovery. But part of that purpose requires a people. And this is something that doesn't change from Old Testament to New Testament. It says in Exodus, and for anyone taking notes, this is Exodus 19 and verse 6. The Lord called a nation of priests. When we look at the Old Testament, we remember that the Old Testament has Levites. The priests are just part of the people, just 1/12 of the tribes. Not everyone is a priest. Not everyone has the right to enter the holy place. Not everyone has the right to minister to the Lord as the priests do. And we tend to think that that was the intent for the Old Testament. But Exodus 19 actually says, I have called a nation of priests. Now, the Lord then has to find a way to work with the fact that the Israelites didn't want to be a nation of priests. And so you end up with the Levites as a result of that very shortly afterwards. But Exodus 19 is very clear. I'm calling a nation of priests, a whole nation who can approach me, a whole nation who can come into the holy place, a whole nation who can stand before me. And that continues in the New Testament. And the most, there are any number of statements, and you could pull a whole line of comments from across various letters and books of the New Testament. But the one that's the most obvious and the closest to the Lord's original words in Exodus are in 1 Peter. 1 Peter 2. I am actually going to read that one because, frankly, I love this verse. This is 1 Peter 2, and I think it's verse 9. And this is in the middle of some very practical advice, amongst other things, just about how to live as believers. I'm going to go back a little bit and just start as verse 5. You also, as living stones, life, 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 the life of the Lord, the flow of the Spirit. You also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Christ Jesus. For this is contained in Scripture. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. Now there's a statement. This precious value then is for you who believe. But for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected became the very cornerstone, and an offence, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence. For they stumble because they are disobedient, and to this doom they were appointed. But you, those who have believed on the Lord, sorry, I'm adding that, but that's who he's talking about. You, who are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the wonders of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. And it is the call to a people, not to a man, no matter how incredible he is, not to one small group, not to a clergy, not to a limited priesthood, but to an entire people. And this is where the idea of a meeting in which we all function comes from. It comes from who we are. The Lord did not call inferior people. It says there aren't many noble, there aren't many mighty, there aren't many wise. By the standards by which this world judges, we are the second class. We're not the rich, we're not the powerful. Some of you may be a little richer, more powerful than others, but on the whole, the church that isn't composed in part of people who are totally messed up, very limited, very restricted, very inadequate in every worldly sense, has never existed. The Lord does not see that. The Lord wants a people worthy of the Creator of the universe. The Lord wants a people worthy of the holiest God. He wants a people who can walk into the Holy of Holies and he can say, yes, they belong here. They belong here. They do not embarrass me. These are people I look at and I can say, yeah, they're mine. They're mine. There's a story I read in Reader's Digest many years ago, which I think expresses what the Lord has done as clearly as anything I've ever read. A description of a tribe, and poor tribe, entirely agricultural. And when they had marriages, the husband had to pay a price to the bride's father. And being poor and rural, the price was paid in cows. My apologies to the women present, this does get better. And the women would sit around in the village talking, my husband paid 4 cows for me. And the women whose husbands had only paid 3 cows would feel a little discouraged. Cows, thank you. Yorkshire. And then the woman whose husband had paid 5 cows. Well, she's the lady of the town. And there was a young, very successful man in the village, and he was the richest man in the area, in the region, and he was unmarried, and he was the catch of the town, and everybody in town wanted him for their daughters. And there was one young woman who everybody knew wasn't in the running. Frankly, her father was hoping to get a calf, never mind a cow, for her. And so when the richest, most successful, most astute businessman in the area came in and said to the girl's father, I've decided I'd like to marry your daughter, everyone goes, well, what's he going to negotiate? I wouldn't be surprised if he actually got something to marry her. That's the expectation. He paid 8 cows. Never ever happened before in the history of the area. No one had, 6 cows was until that time the absolute limit. He paid 8 cows. And the whole village just sat around going, how on earth was this man tricked? How on earth did they get away with this? Stories being told by a journalist who was at the young man's house, and they're being served by this beautiful, elegant, gracious woman. And the journalist's thinking, this must be his mistress, because obviously nothing in this so far has fit the story. And he asked the man, he says, who's that? And he said, oh, that's my wife, the woman I've been telling you about. And he said, I thought you said that no one... He said, why on earth... No, this doesn't make sense. Why did you pay 8 cows for her? He said, oh, it's simple. He said, I know what happens when the women sit around in the village. When they did, I wanted my wife to tell them my husband paid more than anybody else. And she was always this incredible person. She was always that unbelievable bride. She just didn't know it. When I bought her, when I paid the price for her, that's when she knew who she was.
Sure.
And as a declaration of what the Lord did for us and who we are, I have to say I'm struggling to find a better story than that. when we come together, the Spirit of God is not found just in me or just in the three people who are good at speaking. And there will always be people who are better at speaking than others. There will always be people who are better at singing than others. There will always be people who, on average, you'd expect to be more enjoyable to listen to than others. But that has very little to do with it. The Spirit of God inside each and every believer is intended to be heard. How it's heard, how the Lord reveals himself through each and every one of us, that varies. And one thing I will talk about a little later is different ways of expressing the Lord. But just one little example for that. Anna and I sat and prayed together a while back. I'd like to say we do that more regularly than that, but we don't do that as much as we should, and that's entirely my fault. But and we were looking at a particular psalm, and I wrote out something I saw in the psalm, and Anna drew something she saw in the psalm, and what Anna drew and I wrote were exactly the same thing, but expressed in two very different ways. Creativity and imagination actually are important in sharing. Some people can only speak. Some people really are that limited. And one of the things we struggle with is the person and the people in the church who are better at it than we are. It's why the parable of the talents, it's one of the reasons the parable of the talents is in there. The Lord gives different gifts, different abilities to each of us. Whatever the Lord has put in you, he thought worthy to house his Spirit with. And that means that what you have is worth hearing. Even if you don't speak as well as he does or she does, even if you're not as eloquent, even if you're not as learned, the Spirit of God inside us is why, when we come together, the whole body has the ability, never mind the right, the ability to function. And I have to say, I have sat in meetings and heard people who speak a lot and who are good at speaking. On average, this isn't an absolute, but on average, they're worth listening to about half the time. And I've heard people who really struggle to open their mouths, for whom saying three sentences in a meeting is a huge deal. I've never heard anyone like that speak in a meeting and it not be straight from the throne room. The Lord has taken each and every one of us, and we are not what we see. And never mind the condemnation of those around us. I think the worst condemnation most Christians suffer is the condemnation that's in here, that's in their heads. The voice that says to them, you are not. You are not. You are not. You are not. There is another voice. And it is that voice we need to listen to. It is the voice of the Lord inside us. It is the voice of the Spirit of God inside us that says, you are who I say you are, and I don't care about any other evidence. Another story. I'm sure I really should be bringing these stories from Scripture, and there are plenty, but this one, again, this is from a film. How many of you have seen the film A Knight's Tale? Yeah. It's a good film, but there is a moment in it. A man has been masquerading as a nobleman in 14th century England and competing in jousts to make money and to make a living, and as long as, and he's faked things to make him look like a true nobleman, because you have to have noble status to compete, to be any, you have to be somebody. And he's brilliant and everybody loves him, he's a crowd favorite, until somebody finds out his secret, that actually he's the son of a thatcher, he's a complete and utter nobody. And he's of course immediately arrested, he's put in the stocks, people are jeering him. Yesterday he was a hero and they were cheering him to heaven. This morning he's he's nobody, and now everybody's mocking him, they're throwing rotten fruit at him. It's, his life is over. He is a failure. He's reached for the stars and he has not succeeded. He's reached to touch something, to be somebody, and all of that is taken away because it was a fraud. And then the Black Prince walks in, the son of the king, the eldest son of the king. And for anyone who doesn't know who the Black Prince is, he was not just the eldest son of the king. He was the most glamorous member of royalty in Europe at the time. He was the hero, a great military hero, victor of some amazing battles. He's the person you want to be. And just to actually be in his presence and have him say three nice words to you is something you'll be dining out on that for months. He is the ultimate somebody of the time, the closest thing to a celebrity of the age. And the Black Prince walks up the steps to the stocks, and he says, and he just tells the crowd to be quiet. It's the Black Prince. If he says be quiet, you're all quiet. It's that simple. This isn't a discussion. And he says, this man may seem to be a poor peasant. He may seem to be vile. But my personal historian has discovered that he is, in fact, the descendant of an ancient royal house. This is my word, and it is beyond dispute. And at that point, he's a nobleman, a descendant. It doesn't matter that he is the same person he was 2 minutes earlier in the stocks. The king has declared that he is royalty. And that is now the truth. And that is what the Lord has declared over each and every one of us. Whatever we think we are, whatever the voice in our head says, no matter what we can and cannot do, the Lord has looked at us and he has declared, you are a son of the king. You are a descendant of an ancient royal house. The most ancient. We walk into the church. We walk into the gathering of the Lord's people. We belong there. We don't walk in as better and worse. I remember watching the God Channel once, and there was some vast auditorium in which some vast speaker was speaking to some vast crowd. And behind the speaker, I can kind of cope with the speaker. What really annoyed me was behind the speaker was a semicircle of chairs in which were seated a semicircle of elders, many of whom were themselves semicircular in shape. And I saw it and I knew that pretty nearly every man in that auditorium wanted to be in one of those chairs, because we're fallen and that's what our fallen nature desires. Even if the voice in us says, oh, I'm not as good as them, I'm not really one of them, I'm not equal to them. Even if that's what it says, there's also something saying, I wish I was. Because that's what the world recognizes, and that's what our fallen nature recognizes. When we walk into the Lord's house, it's not like that. The Lord's house doesn't have, you know, just about Christian. Reasonable Christian, and getting there Christian, and yeah, these are the people you want to be. Of course, in practice, there are people you might want to listen to, you might lean on more. There are different gifts, there are different abilities. But when we walk into the Lord's house, the Lord doesn't grade us. Thankfully, for which I am extremely grateful. You look at the temple of the Old Testament, and it is a temple of division. We are divided from the Lord. That's the first division. Then we are divided from the priests, who can come so close. Then the women are divided from the men, because men are just naturally holier and can get a bit closer. Yeah, I'm leaving very shortly. the moment the Lord died, not the moment he was resurrected, not the moment his victory was evident, but at the first possible opportunity, the moment of the Lord's death, the veil that divided the Lord from the rest of us, that stood between the Holy of Holies and mankind, was torn from top to bottom. The first chance the Lord had, because that veil was an object of hatred to God. He has never wanted to be divided from us. And when we walk into the Lord's house, we don't walk in as, well, these are the people who are entitled to come this close. These are the people who walk entitled to come this close. We walk in as the Lord's people. And if I stand next to the most capable Christian who's ever lived, we stand before the Lord as equals. Not because I deserve it. Not because I earned it. Not because of my achievements. But because my right to stand there is because of who lives inside me. And his right to stand there, whatever he thinks, whatever he's done, is because of who lives inside him. And that alone is his ground. There are practical things, but this is our starting point. And there is something that is accomplished by the Lord through a people. I want to actually go and look at that verse in Ephesians. And it is in Ephesians 3. This is Paul talking about his calling. This is Ephesians 3. I'm just going to start from verse 7. I was made a minister according to the gift of God's grace, which was given to me according to the working of his power. To me, the very least of all saints. And every time I hear Paul saying that, I have to say, my immediate thought is, you can't really believe that. Surely that's not really what Paul was thinking. He must have known that wasn't true. But actually, Paul heard the same voice that most of us hear. That voice inside him that said, you're not good enough. You don't deserve it. To me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ and to bring to light what is the mystery which for ages has been hidden in God who created all things, so that the wisdom of God might be made known through the church. Not through me, not through a great minister, but through the body, through the church, through the Lord's people. And we see the church sometimes, we read the Bible, and we see the church as the grand, the whole body across all of time and space before the Lord. That's not generally how it's used in the New Testament. It's the church in Rome, the church in Colossae, the church in Ephesus, the churches in Galatia, in the particular towns where they lived, the believers who gather together, the believers who share their lives, the believers who are the expression of Jesus Christ in that place, through the church. That is the revelation. The church in Bognor, the church in... It's a little more difficult now because we have so many denominations and different churches. But the gathering of the Lord's people in a place, the people who share their lives in a place. We are the church that makes known, and I'll continue the verse, to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. The Lord is revealed in heavenly places through the gathering of his people on this earth. It's an incredible statement. The Lord has always been God of heaven. They can see what he is. What exactly does he need help with? What is it they haven't seen? Well, whatever it is, it's done through the church on this earth. To the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. And the Lord achieves his victory for all that he's done. And I can't quite make sense. No, I can't make sense of this. There's too much in here, and there's there's a great deal of richness in here, and it's more than can be covered in just a short day, frankly. But the Lord makes himself known through the gathering of his people on this earth. And in fact, the revelation that we are believers takes a collection of believers together. And the verse, the statement for that is Jesus, "By this will all men know that you are my disciples, that you love one another." It doesn't matter how incredible of an individual you are, you cannot do that on your own. It takes a collection of believers to reveal the Lord. And the meeting is a part of that. And I'm just going to do a little aside. Important as the meeting is, it is a part of the life of the church. And if the meeting is all you have, then don't waste time trying to gather and have everyone share. It will not work. You might manage one or two meetings. The meeting of the whole body and the sharing of the whole body is only possible when it is a part of the life of believers, when we share our lives, when we take care of each other, when the first person we think to call when we're in trouble is our spiritual family. When not only is the first person we call, but the fact that we know that they'll take the call. And that's difficult in practice because, of course, I can only cope with so much. You can only cope with so much. There are people for whom caring for a difficult person in the house just isn't possible, other than for very short periods. There are others the Lord has built to care for people at great length and with great struggle. And that's why we need a church as well. Because I can't do it all. And nor can you, whoever you are. Whatever calling you have, whatever gifts you have, whatever the Lord has given you, you can't do it all. And you weren't meant to. It's not because there was something wrong with you. It's because you weren't meant to. It's the same reason a fish can't fly. It wasn't meant to. And it's not actually a problem that it can't. Christians were meant to be together. And the revelation of the Lord is formed by the life of believers together. And the meeting is a part of that, and only a part of it. And the achievement, of the Lord on this earth through his people is something that has very practical power. I don't believe in, you may disagree with me, but I don't believe in Christian governments. I have no problem with Christians in government. I have no problem with Christians in politics. But I don't believe in a Christian authority on this earth in that sense. What I do believe is that the Lord expresses his authority on this earth through the gathering of his people, and that that has an impact on the nation and on the world. And just to give a few things, there are things we struggle with in this country that we didn't struggle with 50 years ago. Anyone who does counseling knows that. There are things that we do not struggle with in this country that if you live in, picking a country at random, let's say Thailand, you would struggle with. And if you tried to raise a church up, you would have to fight against. We don't have to fight against that. And the main reason for that is because of people who came before us, because of spiritual victory that was won before us. The Lord's people on this earth as a church change this world, regardless of what works we do in the world. The gathering of the Lord on this earth, which is what his people are, changes this world. And we are incredibly fortunate in this country that so many have come before us. There are things we haven't had to deal with. We didn't have to fight against them. Because, I don't know, Methodists, Brethren, Baptists, Congregationalists, Lollards, faced, fought, defeated. And they may not even have faced them directly. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But because they were there, the Lord had authority over principalities and powers. And the gathering of the church, the gathering of the Lord's people, the sharing of our lives, and the pursuit of the Lord together as a body, in and out of the meeting, is essential to that. And without that, this world is an incredibly dark place. We're actually very fortunate, the age we live in, for the most part. There's plenty of evil in it, and we live in a part of the world that's very fortunate. Part of that is because of the struggle that went before us. And every generation has to renew that struggle, because over time, victories won fade on this earth. The Lord never loses anything. The Lord doesn't. He holds these things. But I was asking about how many grandchildren various of you had earlier, and running an informal competition in my head. Congratulations to Tony and Lindsay, the runaway winners. Are they? Okay. Okay. I'll check that later. Your grandchildren will have to face things. Grace has got 40. Well, okay. Well, I've no respect for Tony and Lindsay anymore. Lightweights. There is a spiritual battle to be fought, and it has to be renewed in every generation. We are fortunate that we are not starting at the beginning. But without the Lord's people assembled, a generation to come will be starting at the beginning. It matters that we are here. And sometimes we can see the impact of it, but a lot of the time we can't. And one of my favourite stories, and I'm almost done with this, but one of my favourite stories is the story of a group of Irish Christians at Bosham. This is a largely unknown story. They arrived there in the early 7th century, at a time when Irish Christians were spreading across the world, raising up churches, leading people to Christ, transforming nations, in fact. This man and his small group of followers arrived at Bosham. And they were there for 20, 30 years, and they led not one person to Christ. Their mission was a total and utter failure by every possible human standard. But you can't find many works of the Lord in the United Kingdom which didn't have an impact in Sussex. I don't know that those two things are connected, but I think it's possible. I think it's possible that the fact that the Lord had a presence, they never saw the fruit. That's up to the Lord. But they were faithful, and that mattered. It matters that the Lord has a people gathered in as many places as possible, and the Lord can do more with a grain of mustard seed than I can do or you can do with fields of harvest. But we come in as the people the Lord made us. He doesn't work with failures. Not by his standards. By every other standard, sure. But not by his standard. And what he is at work at is more important than we can imagine. And the gathering together, the mere fact of believers gathering, of coming together as a body, sharing our lives, has power in the heavenly realm. Regardless of what we see, regardless of what's around us, it has power, and it is essential that continue. I think I wanted to really do two sessions today. The first one, really, why does it matter to have an open meeting? And it is part of having a church, an active church, and a gathering of a church. And the second half, I want to talk about some practical things. I want to talk about some things that some of them, and a lot of this will be, I suspect some of the things I will tell you, it'll be, yeah, we know that. And I'm sorry for that. But I'm going to say them anyway because they are what I have. But I want to come back and talk about some practical things and how some of this is expressed and some of the things to remember. And to do so partly from my experience when I was here and partly from my experience down in Bournemouth and Poole, both from things I've seen that worked and things that I've seen that haven't. But the one thing I will say, and I will repeat this when we start that, they are suggestions. One of the worst ideas that Christians have is to look at something that worked and say, right, that's how you do it. If everyone does that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter how good it was or how right it was. It is the life of the Spirit. Without the life of the Spirit, I don't care how right you are. There's a good deal the Pharisees said to Jesus. They were technically right. But their hearts were wrong and the life wasn't there. So, it's suggestions. Suggestions and ideas. And that's, I think, enough from me for now.